This is Audible.
Books on Tape presents Cloud Atlas by David Mitchell. Read by Scott Brick, Cassandra Campbell, Kim Mai Guest, Kirby Hayborn, John Lee, and Richard Matthews. The Pacific Journal of Adam Ewing. Thursday, the 7th of November. Beyond the Indian hamlet, upon a forlorn strand, I happened on a trail of recent footprints. Through rotting kelp, sea coconuts, and bamboo, the tracks led me to their maker, a white man, his trousers and pea jacket rolled up, sporting a kempt beard and an outsized beaver, shoveling and sifting the cindery sand with a teaspoon so intently that he noticed me only after I had hailed him from 10 yards away. Thus it was I made the acquaintance of Dr. Henry Goose, surgeon to the London nobility. His nationality was no surprise. If there be any eyrie so desolate or isle so remote that one may there resort unchallenged by an Englishman, 'tis not down on any map I ever saw. Had the doctor misplaced anything on that dismal shore? Could I render assistance? Dr. Goose shook his head, nodded loose his kerchief, and displayed its contents with clear pride. "Teeth, sir, are the enameled grails of the quest in hand. In days gone by, this Arcadian strand was a cannibal's banqueting hall, yes, where the strong engorged themselves on the weak. The teeth they spat out, as you or I would expel cherry stones. But these base molars, sir, shall be transmuted to gold, and how? An artisan of Piccadilly who fashions denture sets for the nobility pays handsomely for human gnashers. Do you know the price a quarter pound will earn, sir? I confessed I did not. Nor shall I enlighten you, sir, for 'tis a professional secret. He tapped his nose. Mr. Ewing, are you acquainted with Marchioness Grace of Mayfair? No. The better for you. For she is a corpse in petticoats. 5 years have passed since this harridan besmirched my name, yes, with imputations that resulted in my being blackballed from society. Dr. Goose looked out to sea. My peregrinations began in that dark hour. I expressed sympathy with the doctor's plight. I thank you, sir. I thank you. But these ivories... He shook his kerchief. Are my angels of redemption? Permit me to elucidate. The Marchioness wears dental fixtures fashioned by the aforementioned doctor. Next Yuletide, just as that scented she-donkey is addressing her ambassador's ball, I, Henry Goose, yes, I shall arise and declare to one and all that our hostess masticates with cannibals' gnashers. Sir Hubert will challenge me, predictably. Furnish your evidence, that boar shall roar, or grant me satisfaction. I shall declare evidence, Sir Hubert, why I gathered your mother's teeth myself from the spittoon of the South Pacific. Here, sir, here are some of their fellows, and fling these very teeth into her tortoiseshell soup tureen, and that, sir, that will grant me my satisfaction. The twittering wits will scald the icy marchioness in their news sheets, and by next season she shall be fortunate to receive an invitation to a poorhouse ball. In haste, I bade Henry Goose a good day. I fancy he is a bedlamite. Friday, the 8th of November. In the rude shipyard beneath my window, work progresses on the jibboom under Mr. Sykes's directorship. Mr. Walker, Ocean Bay's sole taverner, is also its principal timber merchant, and he brags of his years as a master shipbuilder in Liverpool. I am now versed enough in Antipodes etiquette to let such unlikely truths lie. Mr. Sykes told me an entire week is needed to render the prophetess Bristol fashion. 7 days holed up in the musket seems a grim sentence, yet I recall the fangs of the banshee tempest and the mariners lost overboard, and my present misfortune feels less acute. I met Dr. Goose on the stairs this morning and we took breakfast together. He has lodged at the Musket since middle October after voyaging hither on a Brazilian merchantman, Namorados, from Fiji, where he practiced his arts in a mission. Now the doctor awaits a long-overdue Australian sealer, the Nelly, to convey him to Sydney. From the colony he will seek a position aboard a passenger ship for his native London. My judgment of Dr. Goose was unjust and premature. One must be cynical as Diogenes to prosper in my profession, but cynicism can blind one to subtler virtues. The doctor has his eccentricities and recounts them gladly for a dram of Portuguese pisco, never to excess. But I vouchsafe he is the only other gentleman on this latitude east of Sydney and west of Valparaiso. I may even compose for him a letter of introduction for the Partridges in Sydney, for Dr. Goose and dear Fred are of the same cloth. Poor weather precluding my morning outing, we yarned by the peat fire, and the hours sped by like minutes. I spoke at length of Tilda and Jackson, and also my fears of gold fever in San Francisco. Our conversation then voyaged from my hometown to my recent notarial duties in New South Wales, thence to Gibbon, Malthus, and Godwin via leeches and locomotives. Attentive conversation is an emollient I lack sorely aboard the Prophetess, and the doctor is a veritable polymath. Moreover, he possesses a handsome army of scrim-shandered chessmen, whom we shall keep busy until either the Prophetess's departure or the Nelly's arrival. Saturday, the 9th of November. Sunrise bright as a silver dollar. Our schooner still looks a woeful picture out in the bay. An Indian war canoe is being careened on the shore. Henry and I struck out for Banqueter's Beach in holiday mood, blithely saluting the maid who labors for Mr. Walker. The sullen miss was hanging laundry on a shrub and ignored us. She has a tinge of black blood, and I fancy her mother is not far removed from the jungle breed. As we passed below the Indian hamlet, a humming aroused our curiosity, and we resolved to locate its source. The settlement is circumvallated by a stake fence, so decayed that one may gain ingress at a dozen places. A hairless bitch raised her head, but she was toothless and dying and did not bark. An outer ring of ponga huts, fashioned from branches, earthen walls, and matted ceilings, groveled in the lees of grandee dwellings, wooden structures with carved lintel pieces and rudimentary porches. In the hub of this village, a public flogging was underway. Henry and I were the only two whites present, but three castes of spectating Indians were demarked. The chieftain occupied his throne in a feathered cloak, while the tattooed gentry and their womenfolk and children stood in attendance, numbering some 30 in total. The slaves, duskier and sootier than their nut-brown masters, and less than half their number, squatted in the mud. Such inbred bovine torpor. Pockmarked and pustular with haki-haki, these wretches watched the punishment, making no response but that bizarre, bee-like hum. Empathy or condemnation, we knew not what the noise signified. The whip master was a Goliath whose physique would daunt any frontier prizefighter. Lizards, mighty and small, were tattooed over every inch of the savage's musculature. His pelt would fetch a fine price, though I should not be the man assigned to relieve him of it for all the pearls of Ohoaii. The piteous prisoner, hoar-frosted with many harsh years, was bound naked to an A-frame. His body shuddered with each excoriating lash. His back was a vellum of bloody runes, but his insensible face bespoke the serenity of a martyr already in the care of the Lord. I confess, I swooned under each fall of the lash. Then a peculiar thing occurred. The beaten savage raised his slumped head, found my eye, and shone me a look of uncanny, amicable knowing. As if a theatrical performer saw a long-lost friend in the royal box and, undetected by the audience, communicated his recognition. A tattooed black fella approached us and flicked his nephrite dagger to indicate that we were unwelcome. I inquired after the nature of the prisoner's crime. Henry put his arm around me. Come, Adam. A wise man does not step betwixt the beast and his meat. Sunday, the 10th of November. Mr. Boerhaave sat amidst his cabal of trusted ruffians like Lord Anaconda and his garter snakes. Their Sabbath celebrations downstairs had begun ere I had risen. I went in search of shaving water and found the tavern swilling with tars awaiting their turn with those poor Indian girls whom Walker has ensnared in an impromptu bordello. Raphael was not in the debaucher's number. I do not break my Sabbath fast in a whorehouse. Henry's sense of repulsion equaled to my own, so we forfeited breakfast. The maid was doubtless being pressed into alternative service, and set out for the chapel to worship with our fasts unbroken. We had not gone 200 yards when, to my consternation, I remembered this journal, lying on the table in my room at the musket, visible to any drunken sailor who might break in. Fearful for its safety, and my own, were Mr. Boerhaave to get his hands on it, I retraced my steps to conceal it more artfully. Broad smirks greeted my return, and I assumed I was the devil being spoken of, but I learned the true reason when I opened my door. To wit, Mr. Boerhaave's ursine buttocks astraddle his blackamoor goldilocks in my bed in flagrante delicto. Did that devil Dutchman apologize? Far from it. He judged himself the injured party and roared, "Get ye hence, Mr. Quillcock, or by God's beard I shall snap your tricksy Yankee nib in two." I snatched my diary and clattered downstairs to a riotocracy of merriment and ridicule from the white savages there gathered. I remonstrated to Walker that I was paying for a private room, and I expected it to remain private even during my absence. But that scoundrel merely offered a 1/3 discount on a 1/4 hour's gallop on the comeliest filly in my stable. Disgusted, I retorted that I was a husband and a father, and that I should rather die than abase my dignity and decency with any of his poxed whores. Walker swore to decorate my eyes if I called his own dear daughters whores again. One toothless garter snake jeered that if possessing a wife and a child was a single virtue, why, Mr. Ewing, I be 10 times more virtuous than you be. And an unseen hand emptied a tankard of Shiog over my person. I withdrew ere the liquid was swapped for a more obdurate missile. The chapel bell was summoning the God-fearing of Ocean Bay, and I hurried thitherwards, where Henry waited, trying to forget the recent foulnesses witnessed at my lodgings. The chapel creaked like an old tub, and its congregation numbered little more than the digits of 2 hands. But no traveler ever quenched his thirst at a desert oasis more thankfully than Henry and I gave worship this morning. The Lutheran founder has lain at rest in his chapel cemetery these 10 winters past, and no ordained successor has yet ventured to claim captaincy of the altar. Its denomination, therefore, is a rattle-bag of Christian creeds. Biblical passages were read by that half of the congregation who know their letters, and we joined in a hymn or two nominated by Rota. The steward of this demotic flock, one Mr. Darnock, stood beneath the modest cruciform and besought Henry and me to participate in likewise manner. Mindful of my own salvation from last week's tempest, I nominated Luke chapter 8. And they came to him and awoke him, saying, "Master, Master, we perish." Then he arose and rebuked the wind and the raging of the water, and they ceased, and there was a calm. Henry recited from Psalm the 8th, in a voice as sonorous as any schooled dramatist. "Thou madest him to have dominion over the works of thy hands. Thou hast put all things under his feet, all sheep and oxen, yea, and the beasts of the field, the fowl of the air and the fish of the sea and whatsoever passeth through the paths of the seas. No organist played a Magnificat but the wind in the flue chimney. No choir sang a Nunc Dimittis but the wuthering gulls. Yet I fancy the Creator was not displeased. We resembled more the early Christians of Rome than any later church encrusted with arcana and gemstones. Communal prayer followed. Parishioners prayed ad lib for the eradication of potato blight, mercy on a dead infant's soul, blessing upon a new fishing boat, etc. Henry gave thanks for the hospitality shown us visitors by the Christians of Chatham Isle. I echoed these sentiments and sent a prayer for Tilda, Jackson, and my father-in-law during my extended absence. After the service, the doctor and I were approached most cordially by an elder mainmast of that chapel, one Mr. Evans, who introduced Henry and me to his good wife. Both circumvented the handicap of deafness by answering only those questions they believed had been asked, and accepting only those answers they believed had been uttered, a stratagem embraced by many an American advocate, and their twin sons, Keegan and Diffid. Mr. Evans made it known that every week he had the custom of inviting Mr. Darnock, our preacher, to dine at their nearby home, for the latter dwells in Port Hut, a promontory some miles distant. Would we, too, join their Sabbath meal? Having already informed Henry of that Gomorrah back at the musket and hearing cries of mutiny from our stomachs, we accepted the Evans's kindness with gratitude. Our host's farmstead, seated half a mile from Ocean Bay up a winding, blustery valley, proved to be a frugal building, but proof against those hell-bent storms that break the bones of so many hapless vessels upon nearby reefs. The parlor was inhabited by a monstrous hogshead, afflicted with droop jaw and lazy eye, killed by the twins on their 16th birthday, and a somnambulant grandfather clock, at odds with my own pocket watch by a margin of hours. Indeed, one valued import from New Zealand is the accurate time. An Indian farmhand peered through the windowpane at his master's visitors. No more tatterdemalion a renegado I ever beheld, but Mr. Evans swore the quadroon, Barnabas, was the fleetest sheepdog who ever ran upon two legs. Keegan and Diffid are honest, woolly fellows, versed principally in the ways of sheep. The family own 200 head, for neither has gone to town. The islanders thus appellate New Zealand, nor undergone any schooling save scripture lessons from their father, by dint of which they have learnt to read and write tolerably well. Mrs. Evans said grace, and I enjoyed my most pleasant repast, untainted by salt, maggots, and oaths, since my farewell dinner with Consul Bax and the Partridges at the Beaumont. Mr. Darnock told us tales of ships he has supplied during his 10 years on Chatham Isle, while Henry amused us with stories of patients, both illustrious and humble, he has benefacted in London and Polynesia. For my part, I described the many hardships overcome by this American notary in order to locate the Australian beneficiary of a will executed in California. We washed down our mutton stew and apple dumpling with small ale brewed by Mr. Evans for trading with whalers. Keegan and Diffid left to attend their livestock, and Mrs. Evans retired to her kitchen duties. Henry asked if missionaries were now active on the Chathams, at which Mr. Evans and Mr. Darnock exchanged looks, and the former informed us, "Nay, the Maori don't take kindly to us Pakeha, spoiling their Moriori with too much civilization." I questioned if such an ill as too much civilization existed or no. Mr. Darnock told me, "If there is no God west of the Horn, why, there's none of your constitutions all men created equal neither, Mr. Ewing." The nomenclatures Maori and Pakeha I knew from the prophetess's sojourn at the Bay of Islands, but I begged to know who or what Moriori might signify. My query unlocked a Pandora's box of history, detailing the decline and fall of the aboriginals of Chatham. We lit our pipes. Mr. Darnock's narrative was unbroken 3 hours later when he had to depart for Port Hutt ere nightfall obscured the Dyke Way. His spoken history, for my money, holds company with the pen of a Defoe or Melville, and I shall record it in these pages after, Morpheus willing, a sound sleep. Monday, the 11th of November. Dawn sticky and sunless. The bay has a slimy appearance, but the weather is mild enough to allow repairs to continue on the Prophetess, I thank Neptune. A new mizzentop is being hoisted into position as I write. A short time passed, while Henry and I breakfasted, Mr. Evans arrived hugger-mugger, importuning my doctor friend to attend to a reclusive neighbor, one Widow Bryden, who was thrown from her horse on a stony bog. Mrs. Evans was in attendance and fears that the widow lies in peril of her life. Henry fetched his doctor's case and left without delay. I offered to come, but Mr. Evans begged my forbearance, as the patient had extracted a promise that none but a doctor should see her incapacitated. Walker, overhearing these transactions, told me no member of the male sex had crossed the widow's threshold these 20 years, and decided that the frigid old sow must be on her last trotters if she's letting Dr. Quack frisk her. The origins of the Moriori of Rikohu, the native moniker for the Chathams, remain a mystery to this day. Mr. Evans evinces the belief they are descended from Jews expelled from Spain, citing their hooked noses and sneering lips. Mr. Darnock's preferred theorem, that the Moriori were once Maori, whose canoes were wrecked upon these remotest of isles, is founded on similarities of tongue and mythology and thereby possesses a higher carat of logic. What is certain is that after centuries or millennia of living in isolation, the Moriori lived as primitive a life as their woebegone cousins of Van Diemen's Land. Arts of boat building, beyond crude woven rafts used across the channels betwixt islands, and navigation fell into disuse. That the terraqueous globe held other lands, trod by other feet, the Moriori dreamt not. Indeed, their language lacks a word for race, and Moriori means simply people. Husbandry was not practiced, for no mammals walked these isles until passing whalers willfully marooned pigs here to propagate a parlor. In their virgin state, the Moriori were foragers, picking up poa shellfish, diving for crayfish, plundering bird eggs, spearing seals, gathering kelp, and digging for grubs and roots. Thus far, the Moriori were but a local variant of most flaxen-skirted, feather-cloaked heathens of those dwindling blind spots of the ocean still unschooled by the white man. Old Rikohu's claim to singularity, however, lay in its unique Pacific creed. Since time immemorial, the Moriori's priestly caste dictated that whosoever spilt a man's blood killed his own mana, his honor, his worth, his standing, and his soul. No Moriori would shelter, feed, converse with, or even see the persona non grata. If the ostracized murderer survived his first winter, the desperation of solitude usually drove him to a blowhole on Cape Young, where he took his life. Consider this, Mr. Darnock urged us. 2,000 savages, Mr. Evans's best guess, enshrine thou shalt not kill in word and in deed, and frame an oral Magna Carta to create a harmony unknown elsewhere for the 60 centuries since Adam tasted the fruit of the tree of knowledge. War was as alien a concept to the Moriori as the telescope is to the pygmy. Peace. Not a hiatus betwixt wars, but millennia of imperishable peace rules these far-flung islands. Who can deny old Rikohu lay closer to Moore's utopia than our states of progress governed by war-hungry princelings in Versailles and Vienna, Washington and Westminster? Here, declaimed Mr. Darnock, and here only were those elusive phantasms, the noble savages, framed in flesh and blood. Henry, as we later made our way back to the musket, confessed, "I could never describe a race of savages too backwards to throw a spear straight as noble." Glass and piece alike betray proof of fragility under repeated blows. The first blow to the Moriori was the Union Jack, planted in Skirmish Bay's sod in the name of King George by Lieutenant Broughton of HMS Chatham just 50 years ago. 3 years later, Broughton's discovery was in Sydney and London chart agents, and a scattering of free settlers, whose number included Mr. Evans's father, wrecked mariners and convicts at odds with the New South Wales Colonial Office over the terms of their incarceration, were cultivating pumpkins, onions, maize, and carrots. These they sold to needy sealers, the second blow to the Moriori's independence, who disappointed the natives' hopes of prosperity by turning the surf pink with seals' blood. Mr. Darnock illustrated the profits by this arithmetic. A single pelt fetched 15 shillings in Canton, and those pioneer sealers gathered over 2,000 pelts per boat. Within a few years, the seals were found only on the outer rocks, and the sealers, too, turned to farming potatoes, sheep and pig-rearing on such a scale that the Chathams are now dubbed the Garden of the Pacific. These parvenu farmers clear the land by bushfires that smolder beneath the peat for many seasons, surfacing in dry spells to sow renewed calamity. The third blow to the Moriori was the whalers, now calling at Ocean Bay, Waitangi, Owenga, and Te Wakaru in sizable numbers for careening, refitting, and refreshing. Whalers, cats, and rats bred like the plagues of Egypt and ate the burrow-nesting birds whose eggs the Moriori so valued for sustenance. Fourth, those motley maladies which cull the darker races whene'er white civilization draws near, sapped the aboriginal census still further. All these misfortunes the Moriori might have endured, however, were it not for reports arriving in New Zealand depicting the Chathams as a veritable Canaan of eel-stuffed lagoons, shellfish, carpeted coves, and inhabitants who understand neither combat nor weapons. To the ears of the Ngati Tama and Ngati Mutunga, two clans of the Taranaki Te Ati Awa Maori, Maori genealogy is, Mr. Darnock assures us, every twig as intricate as those genealogical trees so revered by the European gentry. Indeed, any boy of that unlettered race can recall his grandfather's name and rank in a trice. These rumors promised compensation for the tracts of their ancestral estates lost during the recent musket wars. Spies were sent to test the Moriori's mettle by violating tapu and despoiling holy sites. These provocations the Moriori faced as our Lord importuned by turning the other cheek, and the transgressors returned to New Zealand confirming the Moriori's apparent pusillanimity. The tattooed Maori conquistadores found their single barked armada in Captain Harewood of the brig Rodney, who in the dying months of 1835 agreed to transport 900 Maori and 7 war canoes in 2 voyages. In Guerno for seed potatoes, firearms, pigs, a great supply of scraped flax, and a cannon. Mr. Darnock encountered Harewood 5 years ago, penurious in a Bay of Islands tavern. He at first denied being the Rodney's Harewood, then swore he had been coerced into conveying the blacks, but was unclear how this coercion had been worked upon him. The Rodney embarked from Port Nicholas in November, but its heathen cargo of 500 men, women, and children, packed tight in the hold for the 6-day voyage, bilged in ordure and seasickness and lacking the barest sufficiency of water, anchored at Wangetete Inlet in such an enfeebled state that had they but the will, even the Moriori might have slain their martial brethren. The goodly Samaritans chose instead to share the diminished abundance of Rikohu in preference to destroying their mana by bloodletting, and nursed the sick and dying Maori back to health. Maori had come to Rikohu before, Mr. Darnock explained, yet gone away again, So the Moriori assumed the colonists would likewise leave them in peace. The Moriori's generosity was rewarded when Captain Harewood returned from New Zealand with another 400 Maori. Now the strangers proceeded to lay claim to Chatham by Takahi, a Maori ritual transliterated as walking the land to possess the land. Old Rikohu was thus partitioned, and the Moriori informed they were now Maori vassals. In early December, when some dozen aboriginals protested, they were casually slain with tomahawks. The Maori proved themselves apt pupils of the English in the dark arts of colonization. Chatham Isle encloses a vast eastern salt marsh lagoon, Tewanga, very nearly an inland sea but fecundated by the ocean at high tide through the lagoon's lips at Te Awapatiki. 14 years ago, the Moriori men held on that sacred ground a parliament. 3 days it lasted, its object to settle this question. Would the spillage of Maori blood also destroy one's mana? Younger men argued the creed of peace did not encompass foreign cannibals of whom their ancestors knew nothing. The Moriori must kill or be killed. Elders urged appeasement, for as long as the Moriori preserved their mana with their land, their gods and ancestors would deliver the race from harm. Embrace your enemy, the elders urged, to prevent him striking you. Embrace your enemy, Henry quipped, to feel his dagger tickle your kidneys. The elders won the day, but it mattered little. When lacking numerical superiority, Mr. Darnock told us, the Maori seize an advantage by striking first and hardest, as many hapless British and French can testify from their graves. The Ngati Tama and Ngati Matunga had held councils of their own. The Moriori menfolk returned from their parliament to ambushes and a night of infamy beyond nightmare, of butchery, of villages torched, of rapine, of men and women impaled in rows on beaches, of children hiding in holes, scented and dismembered by hunting dogs. Some chiefs kept an eye to the morrow and slew only enough to instill terrified obedience in the remainder. Other chiefs were not so restrained. On Waitangi Beach, 50 Moriori were beheaded, filleted, wrapped in flax leaves, then baked in a giant earth oven with yams and sweet potatoes. Not half those Moriori who had seen old Rikohu's last sunset were alive to see the Maori sun rise. Less than 100 pure-blooded Moriori now remain, mourned Mr. Darnock. On paper, the British Crown freed these from the yoke of slavery years ago, but the Maori do not care for paper. We are 1 week's sail from the Governor's house, and Her Majesty maintains no garrison on Chatham. I asked, why had not the whites stayed the hands of the Maori during the massacre? Mr. Evans was no longer sleeping, and not half so deaf as I had fancied. Have you ever seen Maori warriors in a blood frenzy, Mr. Ewing? I said I had not. But you have seen sharks in a blood frenzy, have you not? I replied that I had. Near enough. Imagine a bleeding calf is thrashing in shark-infested shallows. What to do? Stay out of the water or try to stay the jaws of the sharks? Such was our choice. Oh, we helped the few that came to our door. Our shepherd Barnabas was one. But if we stepped out in that night, we'd not be seen again. Remember, we whites numbered below 50 in Chatham at that time. 900 Maoris altogether. Maoris bide by Pakeha, Mr. Ewing. But they despise us. Never forget it. What moral to draw? Peace, though beloved of our Lord, is a cardinal virtue only if your neighbors share your conscience. Night. The name of Mr. Darnock is not well loved in the musket. A white-black, a mixed-blood mongrel of a man, Walker told me. Nobody knows what he is. Suggs, a one-armed shepherd who lives under the bar, swore our acquaintance is a Bonapartist general hiding here under assumed colors. Another swore he was a Polak. Nor is the word Moriori much loved. A drunken Maori mulatto told me that the entire history of the Aboriginals had been dreamt up by the mad old Lutheran, and Mr. Darnock preaches his Moriori gospel only to legitimize his own swindling land claims against the Maori, the true owners of Chatham, who have been coming to and fro in their canoes since time immemorial. James Coffey, a hog farmer, said the Maori had performed the white man a service by exterminating another race of brutes to make space for us, adding that Russians train Cossacks to soften Siberian hides in a similar way. I protested. To civilize the black races by conversion should be our mission, not their extirpation, for God's hand had crafted them too. All hands in the tavern fired broadsides at me for my sentimental Yankee claptrap. "The best of 'em is not too good to die like a pig," one shouted. "The only gospel the blacks savvy is the gospel of the damned whip." Still another, "We Britishers abolished slavery in our empire. No American can say as much." Henry's stance was ambivalent, to say the least. "After years of working with missionaries, I am tempted to conclude that their endeavors merely prolong a dying race's agonies for 10 or 20 years. The merciful plowman shoots a trusty horse grown too old for service. As philanthropists, might it not be our duty to likewise ameliorate the savages' sufferings by hastening their extinction? Think on your Red Indians, Adam. Think on the treaties you Americans abrogate and renege on time and time and time again. More humane, surely, and more honest, just to knock the savages on the head and get it over with." As many truths as men. Occasionally I glimpse a truer truth, hiding in imperfect simulacrums of itself, but as I approach, it bestirs itself and moves deeper into the thorny swamp of dissent. Tuesday, the 12th of November. Our noble Captain Mullineau today graced the musket to haggle over the price of 5 barrels of salt horse with my landlord. The matter was settled by a rowdy game of Trentuno won by the captain. Much to my surprise, ere he returned to inspect the progress in the shipyard, Captain Mullineau requested some confidential words with Henry in my companion's room. The consultation continues as I write. My friend has been warned of the captain's despotism, but still, I do not like it. Later. Captain Molyneux, it transpires, suffers from a medical complaint which, if untreated, may impair those diverse skills demanded of his station. The captain has therefore proposed to Henry that my friend voyage with us to Honolulu, victualling and private berth gratis, assuming the responsibilities both of ship's doctor and personal physician to Captain Molyneux until our arrival. My friend explained he had intended to return to London, but Captain Molyneux was most insistent. Henry promised to think the matter over and come to a decision by Friday morning, the day now set for the prophetess's departure. Henry did not name the captain's illness, nor did I ask, though one needs not be an Aesculapian to glean Captain Molyneux is a slave to gout. My friend's discretion does him much credit. Whatever eccentricities Henry Goose may exhibit as a collector of curios, I believe Dr. Goose is an exemplary healer, and it is my zealous, if self-serving, hope that Henry returns a favorable answer to the captain's proposal. Wednesday, the 13th of November. I come to my journal as a Catholic to a confessor. My bruises insist these extraordinary past 5 hours were not a sickbed vision conjured by my ailment, but real events. I shall describe what befell me this day, steering as close to the facts as is possible. This morning, Henry paid Widow Bryden's hut another call to adjust her splint and reapply poultice. Rather than submit to idleness, I resolved to scale a high hill to the north of Ocean Bay, known as Conical Tor, whose lofty elevation promises the best aspect of Chatham Isles' backcountry. Henry, a man of maturer years, has too much sense to tramp unsurveyed islands peopled by cannibals. The tired creek who waters Ocean Bay guided me upstream through marshy pastures, stump-pocked slopes, into virgin forest so rotted, knotted, and tangled I was obliged to clamber aloft like an orangutan. A volley of hailstones began abruptly, filled the woods with a frenzied percussion, and ended on a sudden. I spied a robin blackbreast, whose plumage was tarry as night and whose tameness bordered on contempt. An unseen tui took to song, but my inflamed fancy awarded it powers of human speech. "Eye for an eye," it called ahead, flitting through its labyrinth of buds, twigs, and thorns. "Eye for an eye." After a grueling climb, I conquered the summit grievously torn and scratched at I know not what o'clock, for I neglected to wind my pocket watch last night. The opaque mists that haunt these isles, the aboriginal name Rikohu, Mr. Darnock informs us, signifies son of mists, had descended as I ascended, so my cherished panorama was naught but treetops disappearing into drizzle. A miserly reward for my exertions, indeed. The summit of Conical Tor was a crater, a stone's throw in diameter, encircling a crag-walled depression whose floor lay unseen far beneath the funereal foliage of a gross or more kopi trees. I should not have cared to investigate its depths without the aid of ropes and a pickaxe. I was circumambulating the crater's lip, seeking a clearer trail back to Ocean Bay, when a startling hurroosh sent me diving to the ground. The mind abhors a vacancy and is wont to people it with phantoms. Thus I glimpsed first a tusked hog charging, then a Maori warrior, spear held aloft, his face inscribed with the ancestral hatred of his race. 'Twas but a mollyhawk, wings flapping the air like a windjammer. I watched her disappear back into the diaphanous fog. I was a full yard shy of the crater's lip, but to my horror, the turf beneath me disintegrated like suet crust. I stood on not solid ground, but an overhang. I plunged to my midriff, grasping some grasses in desperation, but these broke in my fingers, and down I plummeted, a mannequin tossed into a well. I recall spinning in space, yelling and twigs clawing my eyes, cartwheeling and my jacket snagging, tearing loose. Loose earth, the anticipation of pain, an urgent, formless prayer for help, a bush slowing but not halting my descent, and a hopeless attempt to regain balance. Sliding, lastly terra firma careering upwards to meet me. The impact knocked my senses out of me. Amidst nebulous quilts and summery pillows I lay, in a bedroom in San Francisco similar to my own. A dwarfish servant said, "You're a very silly boy, Adam." Tilda and Jackson entered, but when I voiced my jubilation, not English, but the guttural barkings of an Indian race burst from my mouth. My wife and son were shamed by me and mounted a carriage. I gave chase, striving to rectify this misunderstanding, but the carriage dwindled into the fleeing distance until I awoke in bosky twilight and a silence, booming and eternal. My bruises, cuts, muscles, and extremities groaned like a courtroom of malcontent litigants. A mattress of moss and mulch, lain down in that murky hollow since the second day of creation, had preserved my life. Angels preserved my limbs, for if even a single arm or leg had been broken, I should be lying there still, unable to extricate myself, awaiting death from the elements or the claws of beasts. Upon regaining my feet and seeing how far I had slid and fallen, the height of a foremast, with no worse damage to my person, I thanked our Lord for my deliverance, for indeed, thou calledst in trouble, and I delivered thee. I answered thee in the secret place of thunder. My eyes adjusted to the gloom and revealed a sight at once indelible, fearsome, and sublime. First one, then ten, then hundreds of faces emerged from the perpetual dim, adzed by idolaters into bark, as if sylvan spirits were frozen immobile by a cruel enchanter. No adjectives may properly delineate that basilisk tribe. Only the inanimate may be so alive. I traced my thumbs along their awful visages. I do not doubt I was the first white in that mausoleum since its prehistoric inception. The youngest dendroglyph is, I suppose, 10 years old, but the elders, grown distended as the trees matured, were incised by heathens whose very ghosts are long defunct. Such antiquity surely bespoke the hand of Mr. Darnox Moriori. Time passed in that bewitched place, and I sought to effect my escape, encouraged by the knowledge that the artists of the tree sculptures must earn regular egress from that same pit. One wall looked less sheer than the others, and fibrous creepers offered a rigging of sorts. I was readying myself for the climb when a puzzling hum came to my attention. "Who goes there?" I called. A rash act for an unarmed white trespasser in a heathen shrine. "Show yourself!" The silence swallowed my words and their echo and mocked me. My ailment stirred in my spleen. The hum I traced to a mass of flies orbiting a protuberance impaled on a broken-off branch. I poked the lump with a pine stick and nearly retched, for 'twas a piece of stinking offal. I turned to flee, but duty obliged me to dispel a black suspicion that a human heart hung on that tree. I concealed my nose and mouth in my kerchief and, with my stick, touched a severed ventricle. The organ pulsed as if alive, and my scalding ailment shot up my spine. As in a dream, but it was not. A pellucid salamander emerged from its carrion dwelling and darted along the stick to my hand. I flung the stick away and saw not where that salamander disappeared. My blood was enriched by fright, and I hastened to effect my escape. Easier written than done, for had I slipped and plunged anew from those vertiginous walls, my luck may not have softened my fall a second time. But footholds had been hewn into the rock, and by God's grace I gained the crater's lip with no mishap. Back in the dismal cloud, I craved the presence of men of my own hue, yes, even the rude sailors in the musket, and began my descent on the nonce in what I hoped was a southerly direction. My initial resolve to report all I had seen. Surely Mr. Walker, the de facto, if not de jure, consul, should be informed of the robbery of a human heart? Weakened as I approached Ocean Bay. I am still undecided what to report and to whom. The heart was most likely a hog's, or sheep's, surely. The prospect of Walker and his ilk felling the trees and selling the dendroglyphs to collectors offends my conscience. A sentimentalist I may be, but I do not wish to be the agent of the Moriori's final violation. Footnote. My father never spoke to me of the dendroglyphs, and I learnt of them only in the manner described in the introduction. Now that the Moriori of Chatham Island are a race over extinction's brink, I hold them to be beyond betrayal. J.E. Evening. The Southern Cross was bright in the sky ere Henry returned to the musket, having been detained by more islanders seeking to consult Widow Bryden's healer man on their rheums, yaws, and dropsy. "If potatoes were dollars," rued my friend, "I should be richer than Nebuchadnezzar." He was concerned by my much-edited misadventure on conical tour and insisted on examining my injuries. Earlier I had prevailed upon the Indian maid to fill my bath and emerged much recruited. Henry donated a pot of balm for my inflammations and refused to take a cent for it. Fearing this may be my last chance to consult with a gifted physician,
Henry intends to refuse Captain Molyneux's proposal, I unburden my fears vis-à-vis my ailment. He listened soberly and asked about the frequency and duration of my spells. Henry regretted he lacked the time and apparatus for a complete diagnosis, but recommended, upon my return to San Francisco, I find a specialist in tropical parasites as a matter of urgency. I could not bring myself to tell him there are none. I slumber not. Thursday, the 14th of November. We make sail with the morning tide. I am once more aboard the Prophetess, but I cannot pretend it is good to be back. My coffin now stores 3 great coils of hawser, which I must scale to attain my bunk, for not 1 inch of floor is visible. Mr. Darnock sold 6 barrels of sundry provisions to the quartermaster and a bolt of sailcloth, much to Walker's disgust. He came aboard to supervise their delivery and collect payment himself and bid me Godspeed. In my coffin we were squeezed like 2 men in a pothole, so we repaired to the deck, for it is a pleasant evening. After discussing diverse matters, we shook hands, and he climbed down to his waiting ketch, ably crewed by 2 young manservants of mongrel race. Mr. Roderick has little sympathy with my petition to have the offending hawser removed elsewhere, for he is obliged to quit his private cabin, for the reasons stated below, and move to the forecastle with the common sailors, whose number has swollen with 5 Castilians poached from the Spaniard at anchor in the bay. Their captain was the portrait of a fury, yet short of declaring war on the Prophetess, a battle sure to bloody his nose, for he pilots the leakiest tub. He can do little but thank his stars Captain Molyneux required no more deserters. The very words California bound are dusted in gold and beckon all men thitherwards like moths to a lantern. These 5 replace the 2 deserters at the Bay of Islands and the hands lost in the tempest, but we are still several men short of a full crew. Finbar tells me the men grumble over the new arrangements, for with Mr. Roderick lodged in their forecastle, they cannot yarn freely over a bottle. Fate has dealt me a fine compensation. After paying Walker's usurious bill, nor did I tip that scoundrel a cent, I was packing my jackwood trunk when Henry entered, greeting me thus. Good morning, shipmate. God has answered my prayers. Henry has accepted the post of ship's doctor, and I am no longer friendless in this floating farmyard. So ornery a mule is the common sailor that instead of gratitude a doctor shall be on hand to splint their breakages and treat their infections, one overhears them moaning, what are we to carry a ship's doctor who can't walk a bowsprit? A royal barge? I must confess to a touch of pique that Captain Molyneux afforded a fair-paying gentleman such as myself only my lamentable berth, when a more commodious cabin lay at his disposal all along. Of far greater consequence, however, is Henry's promise to turn his formidable talents to a diagnosis of my ailment as soon as we are at sea. My relief is indescribable. Friday, the 15th of November. We got under way at daybreak, notwithstanding Friday is a Jonah amongst sailors. Captain Molyneux growls, superstitions, saints' days, and other blasted fripperies are fine sport for popish fishwives, but I am in the business of turning a profit. Henry and I did not venture on deck, for all hands were busy with rigging, and a southerly blows very fresh with a heavy sea. The ship was troublesome last night and is not less so today. We passed 1/2 the day arranging Henry's apothecary. Besides the appurtenances of the modern physician, my friend owns several learned volumes in English, Latin, and German. A case holds spectra of powders in stoppered bottles labeled in Greek. These he compounds to make various pills and unguents. We peered through the steerage hatch towards noon, and the Chathams were ink stains on the leaden horizon, but the rolling and pitching are unsafe for those whose sea legs have vacationed the week ashore. Afternoon.
Torgny the Swede knocked on my coffin door. Surprised and intrigued by his furtive manner, I bade him enter. He seated himself upon a pyramid of hawser and whispered that he bore a proposal from a ring of shipmates. "Tell us where the best veins are, the secret ones you locals are keeping for yourselves. Me and my fellows'll do the pack work. You'll just sit pretty and we'll cut you in a tenth share." I required a moment to understand that Torgny was referring to the Californian mining fields. So, a widespread desertion is in the offing once the prophetess reaches her destination, and I own my sympathies are with the seamen. Saying so, I swore to Torgny that I possessed no knowledge of the gold deposits, for I have been absent this 12-month. But I would gratis compose a map illustrating the rumored El Dorados, and gladly. Torgny was agreeable. Tearing a leaf from this journal, I was sketching a schema of Sausalito, Benicia, Stanislaus, Sacramento, etc., when a malevolent voice spoke out. "Quite the oracle, no, Mr. Quillcock?" We had not heard Boerhaave descend the companionway and nudge open my door. Torgny cried in dismay, declaring his guilt in a trice. "What, pray," continued the first mate, "what business have you with our passenger, pustule of Stockholm?" Torgny was struck dumb, but I would not be cowed and told the bully I was describing the sights of my town, the better for Torgny to enjoy his shore leave. Boerhaave raised his eyebrows. "You allot shore leave now, do you? New news to my old ears. That paper, Mr. Ewing, if you please." I did not please. My gift to the seamen was not the Dutchman's to commandeer. "Oh, begging your pardon, Mr. Ewing. Torgny, take receipt of your gift." I had no choice but to hand it to the prostrate Swede. Mr. Boerhaave uttered, "Torgny, give me your gift instanter, or by the hinges of hell, you shall regret the day you crawled from your mother's—" My quill curls at recording his profanity. The mortified Swede complied. "Most educational," remarked Boerhaave, eyeing my cartography. "The captain will be delighted to learn of the pains you are taking to better our scabby jacks, Mr. Ewing. Torgny, you're on masthead watch for 24 hours. 48 if you're seen taking refreshment. Drink your own piss if you get a thirst." Torgny fled, but the first mate was not finished with me. "Sharks ply these waters, Mr. Quillcock. Trail ships for tasty jetsam they do. Once I saw one eat a passenger. He, like you, was neglectful of his safety and fell overboard. We heard his screams. Great whites toy with their dinner, gnawing them slow, a leg here, a nibble there, and that miserable bastard was alive longer than you'd credit. Think on it." He shut my coffin door. Boerhaave, like all bullies and tyrants, takes pride in that very hatefulness which makes him notorious. Saturday, the 16th of November. My fates have inflicted upon me the greatest unpleasance of my voyage to date. A shade of old Rikohu has thrust me, whose only desiderata are quietude and discretion, into a pillory of suspicion and gossip. Yet I am guilty on no counts save Christian trustingness and relentless ill fortune. 1 month to the day has passed since we put out from New South Wales, when I wrote this sunny sentence, "I anticipate an uneventful and tedious voyage." How that entry mocks me. I shall never forget the last 18 hours, but since I cannot sleep nor think, and Henry is now abed, my only escape from insomnia now is to curse my luck on these sympathetic pages. Last night I retired to my coffin, dog-tired. After my prayers, I blew out my lantern, and lulled by the ship's myriad voices, I sank into the shallows of sleep when a husky voice inside my coffin awakened me, wide-eyed and afraid.
Mr. Ewing,
beseeched this urgent whisper. Do not fear.
Mr. Ewing.
No harm.
No shout, please, sir.
I jumped involuntarily and knocked my head against the bulkhead. By the twin glimmers of amber light through my ill-fitted door and starlight,